Iambic Audiobooks presents The Great Lenore by J.M. Tolleen. Read by John Greenman. Chapter 01. Dear reader, read this and fly. Ah! Broken is the golden bowl, the spirit flown forever. Let the bell toll. A saintly soul floats on the Stygian river. And Guy de Vere, hast thou no tear? Weep now, or never more. See, on yon drear and rigid bier, lo, lies thy love, Lenore. Come, let the burial rite be read, the funeral song be sung, an anthem for the queenliest dead that ever died so young, a dirge for her, the doubly dead, in that she died so young. Edgar Allan Poe, Lenore. Life is life, and fun is fun, but it is always so quiet when the goldfish die. Beryl Markham, West with the Night. Chapter 1. When I met Lenore, she'd been dead for 4 days.
"I'm so sorry," she said.
She stood on the back patio with water dripping from her hair. She looked cold.
"I feel awful for barging in like this. I hope I'm not being a bother. I couldn't go next door, you know."
"I know," I said. The Atlantic stretched out behind her like an angry black sheet. The rain chased itself into the water.
"Oh, I'm sorry. Here."
She held out her hand.
"I'm Lenore."
"Lenore, right." Her eyes kissed mine as she brushed past me. I opened my mouth to say something. Nothing. Lenore reached the fireplace, and she plucked the poker up from beside the brick facade and stuck it into the dying embers. Ashes rose. The coals glowed brighter.
"Is there any more wood?"
she said. Her voice was mesmerizing. The British accent lingered in the air long after the words faded. She had to repeat her question before I realized what she had asked.
"Yeah, sure. Sure," I said. "I'll run out and get some."
I returned from outside with 2 fresh logs, rain sliding down my face, the cold pounding inside my chest. And Lenore was sitting in front of the fireplace, wrapped in a blanket. Her smile left my legs in desperate need of strength. I reached the fireplace and let the logs tumble in amongst the coals.
"Thank you, Richard. You really are a sweetheart. Come down here and let me kiss you."
I bent down close to her, and she placed her fingers on my chin and tilted my face. Her lips touched my forehead. The flames licked the wood. I learned a long time ago that people gravitate toward mystery. I'm not much of a mysterious man myself, not in my own estimation, at least. I'm really very much normal. But over the years I've discovered that many people mistake me for mysterious, and this misconception has led me into some strange friendships. Fittingly, it was one such friendship that began this whole story, my friendship with Sandy Benucci. I met Sandy during my freshman year of college. He was my roommate that year, and for 2 other years also, and he was the opposite of me in every way imaginable. While I preferred thought over noise, Sandy preferred to be loud and obnoxious and utterly unambitious. And while I had all the social aspirations of a hermit, Sandy was gregarious and likable, and he became popular around campus. I probably would have hated college if not for our friendship. He made me feel alive. One of the habits that Sandy picked up during our first year together, endlessly annoying but creating great results, was a tendency to drag me places and introduce me to his friends.
"This is my roommate, Richard," he used to say. "Doesn't he look exactly like Denzel Washington?"
I don't look exactly like Denzel Washington, but that was exactly how he always introduced me. Since that time, a lot in my life has changed, but one thing that hasn't changed is Sandy. Even after I got to be, well, I wouldn't really call myself famous, but we'll say well-known, even after I got to be well-known, Sandy was still the same. I was still his,
"Good buddy Richard, doesn't he look exactly like Denzel Washington?"
And he was still old sandy-haired Sandy. It was in the fall of last year that he called me and began this whole story.
"Rich," he said to me as soon as I said hello, "my family is wintering in Europe this year, out in Germany or some crap like that. Gonna study up our roots. Anyhow, I was thinking the other day, and I thought I could do you a favor."
"A favor?"
"Exactly. Look, we have that beach house out on Nantucket, right? But none of us are going to get any use of it this winter. You know, we'll all be out in Hitler's backyard. And what I realized is I hate for the place to go to waste all winter. And didn't you say something about writing your next novel? Seems like I remember that. And I thought you'd maybe enjoy staying out there for the winter, for part of the winter at least. Just sort of look after the place and enjoy it."
I had no plans for the winter, and Sandy was right about me looking for a place where I could relax and be away from it all and work on my next novel, so I told him it all sounded like a pretty good idea. We worked out the details, and I flew into Boston on Friday, the 21st of November. Sandy picked me up at the airport that evening, and that night we crashed with Shannon, an old friend of ours from Fairfield, who was playing house in a small town outside the city with a nice guy named Guy from upstate New York. We had a pleasant time with Shannon and Guy. Shannon cooked dinner. They shared their wine with us. Guy showed us his license plate collection and his skills on the electric guitar.
"It's just a hobby," he told us, as he slung the strap over his head. "Just a hobby, you know, but I enjoy it."
And it was nice to see her and fine to meet him. But, really, I was ready to get to Nantucket. I wanted to settle in. I wanted to begin writing. I figured we would head to Nantucket when we woke up on Saturday. But when we woke up on Saturday, we headed into the city.
"I want you to meet my good buddy Maxwell," Sandy said.
"Sandy, really? Can't we just..."
"Come on, Rich. You'll like this guy."
"Sandy, you will."
"What?" "You'll like him, Rich. I'm absolutely certain."
Honestly, it all seemed like more trouble than it was worth, battling the traffic, getting flipped off by strangers, narrowly avoiding car wrecks and wrecks with pedestrians. Looking back, it's funny in that, yeah, it's catastrophic and all you can do is laugh, sort of way. That introduction to Maxwell was so catalytic, and yet it seemed so unexceptional at the time. This is what the scene looked like when we arrived at Maxwell's apartment in the Back Bay in Boston. Sandy knocked, and the door flew open. Maxwell stood in the doorway wearing a Beatles t-shirt, ripped jeans, and a magnanimous smile, the kind of mischievous, childlike smile that makes women go all weak. And smoke curled from a cigarette in one hand, and he held a glass of scotch in the other.
"Sandy!"
Both men yelled and embraced like kids, and a sliver of scotch leapt from the glass and landed on Sandy's shoulder. Neither man noticed. They let go of each other and shoved their way back into the apartment.
"Here's my buddy Richard," Sandy said, struggling out of his coat.
"Richard, how are you, brother? I'm Maxwell."
Maxwell shifted the cigarette to his mouth and offered me his hand. I gripped it tight, looked him in his eyes.
"A pleasure to meet you," I told him. "You have a lovely place here."
Whoa, Maxwell said, and he laughed,
and he removed the cigarette and slurped a messy sip from the glass.
"Where'd you find this cat, huh, Sandy? Pleasure to meet you. Lovely place. Come on, brother."
He slapped my shoulder.
"Lighten up a bit, huh?"
He turned without noticing the scathing look I gave him, and he drifted deeper into his sumptuous, softly lit apartment.
"When are you flying out, anyway?"
he called to Sandy. I heard bottles clanking in some invisible corner of the apartment, and Sandy returned with two bottles in one hand and two glasses in the other.
"Where the hell's your ice, old Max?"
Max plopped down on the couch. He pointed vaguely.
"Back in the bar. Didn't you see it? I got this new ice maker installed, just above the sink."
Sandy disappeared again, and Maxwell patted the couch.
"Sit down," he said to me. "You smoke?"
I chose a different chair on the opposite wall, and I eased into it slowly.
"Sure," he said. "Sit over there. That's fine, too."
Maxwell stubbed out his cigarette in an ashtray that was shaped like an upturned turtle shell. Then he gulped more alcohol and lit a new cigarette.
"Richie,"
he said. He blew smoke at the ceiling.
"If you could choose one Hollywood chick to get with, who would it be?"
Sandy came back into the room and handed me a glass. I looked at my watch, and I shrugged and took a sip.
"So, Max," Sandy said, as he sat beside Maxwell, "you'll never guess who I hooked up with last weekend. Go on, have a guess."
"I don't know."
"Just have a guess."
"Two-Tooth Tammy." "Oh, come on." "Look, I don't give a damn," Maxwell said. He looked at me and smiled. "Sandy's always trying to brag about these girls he hooks up with, but I'm telling you right now, half his stories are lies."
"Lies my ass! Hey, look at Richard. Tell me who he looks like."
Maxwell drank his drink and pointed at me with his cigarette.
"Richie, he ever gone date-popping? Doesn't he look exactly like Denzel Washington?"
"He doesn't look a damn sight like Denzel Washington."
I took a sip of my drink. We drank a lot that night. We drank too much, in fact, and then we marched raucously into the streets of Boston and began playing what Maxwell referred to as social sports, the particular social sport of the evening being what Maxwell called date-popping, which involves stumbling intoxicated into restaurants and trying to break up dates by pretending to be a jealous lover, or an angry sibling, or some sort of past-life embarrassment. And by the time I dropped Sandy off at the airport on Sunday and moved to Nantucket for what I thought would be for good, or at least for the winter, I was desperately happy to be there at last, and I desperately needed sleep. I slept all evening and all night on Sunday, and on Monday morning I awoke feeling refreshed. I brewed a pot of coffee, and I sat on the back patio. The crisp air slicing off the ocean, the contemplative mornings. I miss those things about Benucci Manor. I miss a lot of things, actually, the stateliness, the beauty, the everything about it. I miss the quiet magnificence. I miss the understated majesty. Benucci Manor rests along the eastern shoreline of Nantucket, on some of America's most exclusive real estate, and it rests there as if resting exactly where it belongs. There is no self-consciousness about Benucci Manor's perfection. There is nothing about the house, or the view, or the landscaping that says, "Look at us, we're rich and important. We're trying really hard." The house is massive, and its grounds are like heaven. The view could knock you out, even if you saw it every day, and nothing about it seems remotely out of place. Of course, there is plenty that I do not miss about Benucci Manor as well. There is plenty that I think about whenever I think about that place that makes me wish I had never gone there. At the time, however, everything seemed promising. Everything seemed unwritten.
Ha! Unwritten!
I feel like an old man right now, reminiscing over a long-dead past. But the past that I am remembering has barely begun to decompose. The past that I am remembering continues to seep into my present. I laugh at the word unwritten because, quite simply, had I been able to write while I was on Nantucket, after all, that's what I went there for in the first place, I might have kept my nose where it belonged, that is, confined to my own business. But, my lot was not so lucky. I was unable to write on my first morning at Benucci Manor, so I explored the house. I explored the grounds. I continued to drink mugs full of coffee, which in time became glasses full of whiskey. And I sat on the back patio and watched the grass that undulated like wind-tickled water until it bumped into sand, and the sand fell down into the ocean. I thought my thoughts, and I awaited inspiration. I spent a lot of time outside during that day and the next. Ideas and inspiration continued to elude me, but I didn't so much mind. At the time, it was pleasant. I slipped from an envious possession of Benucci Manor into a homesteader's proud occupation. One thing that particularly caught my critical eye during this time, as I began to think of Benucci Manor in terms of mine, and began to judge and belittle both the abodes and the lives of others, was the house just south of Benucci Manor, a garish and tasteless affair that I referred to from the outset as the Palace. The Palace was overlarge. It was gaudy. By the end of my first day at Benucci Manor, I began to glance toward the Palace periodically with a distaste that bordered on rancor, and I wondered what sort of awful people must live there. At times, often at my drunkest, I simply watched the palace as if waiting for it to mobilize itself, whereupon it would likely begin to attack the homes and land around it. On Tuesday, my second full day on Nantucket, and still unable to write, I sat on the back patio of Benucci Manor in the afternoon, drinking whiskey and staring across the Atlantic and trying my damnedest to ignore the leering bulk of the palace on the periphery. Wind gushed off the face of the water, and I heard a car door shut. I stood. I set the whiskey on the table beside me. I stretched my arms and legs. I looked at the ocean, for no other reason than that the ocean was spectacular, and I leaned around the corner of the patio, around the corner of the house. I gazed across the day. The sun trickled down through the clouds in droplet-sized pieces. The day was gorgeous, and the grass unfolded like a big green blanket. There were two cars in the driveway of the palace, all abuzz with life. I leaned forward. There was a woman on the front walk of the palace. As I was standing so far away, and was wearing a rather thick pair of whiskey goggles to boot, it was difficult to tell exactly what the woman looked like. But I got the impression that she was a young woman, and that she was absolutely stunning, and that her hair was probably red. She walked like an angel, and looked like an angel, and when she reached the front porch of the palace, she stopped and pushed her hair back and turned, and she called to someone at the cars. From the other side of the cars I heard a voice answer, a man's voice. I watched. The day watched. The whole world watched. The man appeared from around the side of the cars, a big man, with hulking shoulders and a cruel, muscular body. The girl didn't hear his answer, and he answered her again. I didn't move. I kept watching. It looked like the girl sighed, like maybe she turned around with a huff, and she slipped inside of the palace. The big, muscular man followed from the cars. I watched, and more people followed from the cars. A young man, hair placed impeccably, dressed like a 1920s businessman. Two older people. Maxwell. Maxwell, I thought. I took a step back. Is that Maxwell? Watching, thinking. I picked up my whiskey. Perhaps I already knew that Maxwell's family owned the palace, but if I knew, I certainly did not remember. I took a sip of my whiskey. Perhaps that's something Sandy had told me, sometime after he introduced me to Maxwell. If that's something he had told me... The sun is also rising outside of my window, piercing the blinds and stretching itself in thin lines across the cold wooden floor. I am sitting at an ill-lit desk in a flat above the left bank of the Seine River, near the spot where Ernest Hemingway wrote his second novel. I have been living here for a couple of weeks. The flat is bare and ugly. One of my neighbors has a baby that sleeps during the day, and it wakes up at nighttime to cry and cry. Across the way there is a dog who waits at a slat in the gate and barks at every passer-by. The road carries a lot of foot traffic, and people pass the dog all day. I don't know many people here, not yet. I don't know the language too well. Sometimes I feel lonely, and, as was the case during my time on Nantucket, I have been unable to write. However, I am no longer on Nantucket. I am an ocean away. This, at least, is one thing for which I can be happy. On Wednesday afternoon, now halfway through my third full day on Nantucket, I sat at the desk in the downstairs study and drank whiskey while I stared at my computer. Nothing came to me, no matter how long I waited. The doorbell rang. I continued to stare at my computer as if something would somehow change. The doorbell rang again. I slammed my computer shut. I took a gulp of my whiskey. I banged the glass down onto the table. The doorbell rang a third time. I stood from my chair and stood still for a moment to make certain I had my balance, and I made my way to the foyer with the gracious help of the walls. I pulled the door open. I peered out into the world. Standing there on my own front porch and looking endlessly uncomfortable was the hulking brute from the next house over.
"Hey,"
he said.
"Hi."
He looked to his right at the house from which he'd just come.
"I'm Chaz, Maxwell's brother."
He held out his hand. I gripped it tight. Looked him in his eyes.
"You mind if I come in?"
Allow me to interject an admission about myself, and I admit this largely because this might save me trouble in the future if you and I ever have the fortune of running into one another. I judge most people the moment I meet them, and most often I don't like what I see. It's a flaw of mine, I know. On that day on Nantucket, I stood in the darkness of the foyer wearing jeans and a sweater and an old fedora I had picked up at a thrift store 5 years earlier, and I faced this handsome, overly buff young man standing in the sun with a CEO's haircut and slacks and a dress shirt, and he had asked me, "You mind if I come in?" Inside my head I said, "Yes, I do mind. Of course I mind. Look, I don't really like you. I just met you, and I don't really like you." But out loud, "Oh, sure. Sure, come on in." I kept my hand on the wall again and tried to walk steady, and I led Chaz to the living room and sat down in the salmon-colored chair by the window. I offered him a seat. He didn't take it. He stood there with his hands in his pockets and his eyes wandering all over the room.
"I just came over to see if you'd like to join us tomorrow for Thanksgiving. When..."
He cleared his throat.
"Sorry, oh, yes. When Mama found out you were over here by yourself, she couldn't stand the thought."
"Hmm. Oh, yeah?" My tongue felt thick inside my mouth.
"Yes," he said, and his eyes continued to wander all over the room. "It's important to her that you come."
"Hmm." Chaz left, and I stood in the doorway and watched him. He strode all the way up the driveway of Benucci Manor and along the road until he reached the driveway of the palace. Then he descended upon its absurd luxuriousness from above, as if it would have been too terribly mundane and common to have tramped across the grass. I shook my head. I returned to my desk and opened my computer and stared at my computer. I set my hands on the keyboard. Then I sipped my drink and returned my hands to the keyboard and continued to watch the screen.
"Damn it," I said.
I closed the computer again. I sat on the back patio and watched the ocean, which continued to do the same thing it had been doing for the last 3 days, and I continued to sip my whiskey and to let my mind wander. My mind came around to some sort of opalescent memory. Boston. I could very nearly see it. Boston, the morning after Sandy and Maxwell and I drank too much and wandered hooligan-like around the city, popping dates. Sandy and Maxwell and I sat by the window of a sidewalk cafe, playing around with plates full of food. I still felt drunk from the previous night's escapades of excess, and Sandy and Maxwell talked.
"How's your brother doing?"
Sandy said. He was looking at no one, but Maxwell answered.
"My brother? He's still a royal asshole, if that's what you're asking."
"That's what I figured,"
Sandy said. He laughed.
"What's the deal with him, anyway?"
"What do you mean?"
"What do I don't know what I mean. I'm sort of stoned."
"Yeah?"
Sandy nodded.
"Yeah, brother, me too."
Sandy laughed again. Both guys looked at me and raised their eyebrows. Their faces asked if I was stoned also. I shook my head. They turned back to one another.
"Is your brother still dating that one girl?"
Sandy asked. He picked up his sandwich and set it back down.
Is he still dating her? He married her."
No, not Lenore. I was at that wedding, remember? I don't mean Lenore, I mean the girl he's dating."
"Oh, I don't know."
People walked past the window on the sidewalk. I remember I watched the people. I ate my sandwich, and I listened to Sandy and Maxwell.
"You don't know?"
Sandy said.
"No. I try and stay out of all that. I try and just, you know, ignore."
"I hear you. She's damn good-looking. What's her name?"
"Who?"
"The girl who Chaz is dating."
"Oh, her. Yeah, her name is Lily."
"Lily, that's right, Lily. She's damn good-looking," Sandy said.
"It's Chaz,"
Maxwell said. He scratched his face.
"Of course she's good-looking."
Sandy stared into his sandwich as though it held some sort of secret. When he looked back up, he asked for a cigarette. Maxwell handed him one.
"Yeah,"
Sandy said. He lit the cigarette.
"Old Chaz."
He blew out smoke.
"What a royal asshole."
I continued to sit outside on the back patio of Benucci Manor, thinking about this, and eventually thinking about other things instead. I stood only periodically, only to stumble inside and refill my drink, or relieve myself in the bathroom. The sun set behind me, and the Titanic house blocked the sun so that twilight swirled around me for a while and made the world look soft. The ocean looked pale. The ocean kept moving and making noise, and I sipped my drink and lulled down inside of everything, and time slipped past me, warm and fluent. Maxwell stalked across the grass that night and hailed me from too far away for me to hear what he said. I looked up. I watched him walk toward me. When he reached the back patio, he sat. He grabbed my whiskey and took a big gulp. He set the glass down and thanked me. I said, "Yep." Maxwell said, "Yeah." Both of us said nothing. The sky was clear that night, clear and cold, an ocean sky, a New England sky. Maxwell and I continued to say nothing, and finally he pulled out a joint, and we started to smoke it in silence. "Good God," Maxwell said finally, and he held the smoke in his lungs. "Where's the dynamite, huh?" My arm moved away from me slowly. I grabbed the joint from Maxwell and searched for my mouth. "Damn," Maxwell said. I said nothing. The joint disappeared from my fingers and floated. Smoke escaped my mouth. I took a sip of whiskey. "What time are you coming over tomorrow, anyway?" I didn't answer. "Dude," Maxwell said. I pinched the joint between my fingers, careful not to burn my skin. "Hey," Maxwell said. Hey, dude. Hey, how much of a bitch is my brother, huh? Man, what a bitch, you know?" He pointed the joint at me. He finished it. Killed it beneath his foot. "I really don't know how he got Lenore. Boy, that boggles my mind, brother. My mind." Maxwell pointed at his mind. Whoosh, whoosh. I listened to the water. Whoosh, whoosh. Neither of us spoke. Neither of us needed to. We waited for absolutely nothing. Whoosh, whoosh. "Hey," Maxwell said. I looked at him. "You want to smoke another one?" Maxwell and I either smoked another joint, or we didn't, I don't remember. And then we moved inside. I sat in the salmon-colored chair by the window, and Maxwell laid across the couch that I'd offered to his brother earlier in the day. Somewhere a clock ticked. Somewhere time disappeared. Both of us stared at separate spots on the wall and swam through the morass of our drug-addled brains, and we sat so close to one another, and we drifted through worlds that were so far apart. I dozed off for a bit. Maxwell woke me with this.
"What the hell was she thinking?"
I sat there slumped in the chair. I said nothing, but Maxwell said nothing also. So finally I just said, "Who knows?"
"My brother is such a prick," he told the wall. "Such a prick. Like, I mean, he doesn't even care about her. I'm not saying I care. I don't, you know?"
"Of course not."
"But I'm just saying."
He reached for his drink.
"Say," he said, "what'd he say to you this afternoon?"
"Nothing." I closed my eyes and opened them again. It took effort. "He didn't say much," I said. "He just stopped by, really. Said he hates your rotten guts." Maxwell's drink spurted out of his mouth in a spray of laughter.
"He probably did, man. He probably did say that. I'm not kidding, huh?"
Somewhere a clock ticked. Somewhere time disappeared, building a mountain beneath us like so many grains of sand. A mountain on which we all stand, which is always growing higher. A mountain down the side of which no one will ever descend.
"He tell you to come over tomorrow?"
"He told me that your mom couldn't stand the thought of me being here all alone." Maxwell laughed again, and more alcohol was wasted.
"Well, you meet my mom, man. Hey, hey."
He leaned over the edge of the couch, and his fingers brushed the ground. He looked at me, or at least he tried to.
Want to know what my mom's going to say, huh? The moment you meet her?
I shrugged.
The moment you meet her. I'm not kidding, okay? I absolutely promise. The moment you meet her and say whatever, say, "Hi, Mrs. Montana, nice to make your acquaintance," or whatever the hell it is that someone like you'll say, she'll shake your hand all jolly-like, and she'll smile real big and go, "Oh, dear, I'm just thrilled to meet you. Call me Mama, okay? That's what they all call me, Mama Montana." I swear to it, man, it's the way it goes every damn time. The corniest thing you ever saw.
That doesn't sound so bad.
Doesn't sound so bad.
Maxwell tried to sit. He gave up after a couple of seconds, and his head lolled back down onto the cushions. He fidgeted his fingers.
Doesn't sound so bad, huh? It's all a big act, man. That's all it is. I bet, man, I bet they even planned it, even. That's what I think. Like, for business and all. Dad plays the stoic gentleman, and Mom plays the matronly wife. The matronly mother, whatever.
His voice began to trail off, as if he thought about something else.
And it works, man. That's the crazy damn thing. It absolutely works. For years it has. Anytime anyone comes home to the house, Dad's all the strong, big boss, whatever. And she's all Mama Montana. Hell, he said.
He looked at the floor. His words became thinner.
I'm surprised she didn't go and put on about 100 pounds to make herself look like old Mother Hen. Some shit like that. I guess she couldn't go that far, though. You know? She's also got to look the part of the rich executive's wife, or whatever.
Doesn't sound so bad, I said again.
Believe me, he said. It is.
He rolled back over, buried his face in the couch. If I had to guess, I would tell you this. Maxwell probably was no longer in that room with me at all. He probably had his eyes closed, and he was thinking about Lenore.